For instance, he after he left Potter Bible College, where in where James A. Harding was, he had followed Harding to Bowling Green from the Nashville Bible School, where he had gone to school. Then he left the Potter Bible School and went to Missouri to establish the Western Bible and Literary Institute. And it's amazing of the people who graduated there. So many of them went to Africa as missionaries. How many of you have used the great songs of the church in your assemblies? E.L. Jurgensen was a student of his at the Institute, as was Don Carlos Janes, probably the best proponent of foreign missions within Churches of Christ in the first half of the 20th century. Both of them premillennialists. So my point is, Jan Armstrong didn't necessarily draw those lines. He was not sectarian. He was a truth seeker. And I believe the biography of him makes that conclusion too. So this is what we're going to be dealing with today. Health issues caused him to move on westward, asthma and so forth, so he couldn't stay there. So he went to Oklahoma, Cordell, where he established a school. And this is also where Sally Hockaday went to school under him. Then he got caught up in World War I, where he was a conscientious objector, and the people in the community, boy, really came down hard on him. And so he had to leave. And so he went to Harper, Kansas, where he became the president of Harper College in Harper, Kansas. And there, George Benson became one of his students. See how all of it works? and then from there, Benson went to Oklahoma A&M, Oklahoma State now, took courses, went to Harding to finish up, transferred back to Oklahoma State or Oklahoma A&M to graduate, so it would be an accredited degree. That probably was a good thing for what he wanted to do later. And then in 1925, and I think under the influence a lot of Don Carlos Janes, who had made a trip around the world in 1921 and 1922 to visit missionaries, Africa and so forth, and he came to Marlton. And I'm sure that he talked about China, the needs of China. And I think he'd already been thinking about it, so had Sally. And so in 1925, they get married. Now we'll get to that in a minute. But my point is, they chose to go to China in 1925 as missionaries. And I think without realizing the magnitude of what they were doing, they began a legacy that impacted Churches of Christ in China, Hong Kong, the Philippines, and Zambia late in life. That's one of the reasons I say it's a legacy, because that's what he really wanted to do. So let's see if we can move on faster. There's Sally. That picture was taken in the 1920s. It's in a missionary pictorial that was published by Don Carlos Janes. And I took the pictures off of that with my camera, my phone. So it came out pretty good, didn't it? And my point is, Sally must not be overlooked, because she, and I think this is true of a lot of women in missions, that we tend to mention the man's name and never the wife's name. But you've got to mention her, because she was a strong woman, came out of strong stock out of Oklahoma. And she operated a school to teach English in Canton. So on July the 22nd, 1925, George Benson and Sally Hockaday were joined in marriage. And then on August the 18th, 1925, they booked a ship in San Francisco for China with a stop in Japan. On board that same ship were Barney and Nellie Moorhead. Now, you don't know whether you ever heard of them or not. He published, after he came back from Japan in 1930, he began publishing a magazine called World Vision that emphasized foreign missions. And like Don Carlos Jaynes, he became a one-man missionary society. He raised money for missionaries. And he was even responsible, as I said in the last session, for establishing the King Bible School in Oda, Japan. He had just graduated from Lipscomb, but then the Bensons went on to Hong Kong and arrived there September the 24th, 1925. They had met on board ship W.G. Smith and his wife, who were headed to China, inland China, about several hundred miles inland on the West River. So the Bensons decided that would be a good place to go. They invited the Bensons to live with them, where they could study language, and even made a trip on further into the inland to see what might be available there. But after all the problems that China has, in 1925, you had to remember that in 1921, the Communist Party was established in China. You had the nationalist government coming into being under Chiang Kai-shek. You had all the bandits. You had the different prefectures or the different provinces fighting each other. They flew airplanes and everything else, bombing. I mean, it was really bad. So they had to go back to Hong Kong. But it was probably a good thing, because there they were able to study language in peace, and also become involved with a church in Hong Kong. In 1927, I'm getting ahead of myself. They also met when they got to Hong Kong, and she had just arrived back in China, Ethel Mattley. She had been a number in China for a number of years, and she was very helpful to the Bensons. And I'm going to mention a little bit later, but I'll mention it now. She had gone to China as a Baptist missionary. Now, I don't know what changes she made in between to go back as being sponsored by a church, the Central Church in Los Angeles, but she went back to China as a missionary in Churches of Christ. And she was a dogged type person. I mean, she was determined to stay in inland China to work with the people there. And also in 1927, 2 years later, the Bensons and Mattley welcomed two missionary families, the Lewis Oldhams and the Emmett Brodesses. Lewis Oldham was a graduate of Harding. He and Benson had, of course, had known each other there. He had been a student of J.N. Armstrong. And so here is that Armstrong influence there. The Brodesses were a little different. They got married in 1925 in Los Angeles, and I'm not sure how they got there, because she was from Gallatin, Tennessee, and he was from Lancaster, Kentucky. And they left there to go back to Nashville, to Lipscomb, but he didn't stay there long. He moved to Louisville. And when he and Margaret came to Hong Kong, they were in Louisville, Kentucky. She was from Gallatin, Tennessee. And if any of you know anything about the church in Gallatin, it was probably the premier premillennialist church in Middle Tennessee, the downtown church. And it may still be premillennial, as far as I know, because there's the mainline church is out on the Hartsville Pike. Olmsted and all the good premillennial folks preach there. So anyway, Oldham will become an associate with Benson in his China work, but Brodus will spend time in inland China, where he would really like to, and I think Margaret was a very strong person in all of this, that would like to have spent time in inland China, but they were there when bombs barely missed them, when the planes flew over and dropped bombs. I mean, they were almost killed. And so as time went on, They did spend more time in Hong Kong, but would always wanting to go into inland China. The Benson and Oldham, with Chinese help, established a church in Hung Hum across the strait from Kowloon, in Kowloon. It was a section of Hong Kong. I think that's where the main airport is for Hong Kong and everything. It's a poor section, but the people came in good numbers, mainly the children. In fact, they had to limit the number of the children coming to their services to 30 minutes, and then they would chew them out so the adults could get into their little storefront building. But they established a church there. But then, of course, they had to use a Chinese convert to work with the church, because now you have to understand the history of China from middle of the 19th century, with when Protestant churches then were allowed to come into China. They looked upon white folks from Europe and America as foreign devils. And they really didn't care to listen to foreign devils, or even the Chinese people, men who were converted by them, because they were their lackeys. So, you know, and when you had to teach them from the very first point, Mike, who is God? Who's Jesus? It's not like going in, say, the Philippines, where they knew that, but China, Vietnam, no. Now, so while in Hong Kong in 1928, George Pepperdine visited Hong Kong. Wasn't there long, but he was there long enough to tell Benson, because both of them had visited the Philippines, that he needed to go to the Philippines and see what was possible in establishing a church or churches. And so he provided $400 for Benson. You say, well, that's not much money, but it was all right then. For $400 for the Bensons to go to the Philippines. He left Sally and his young daughter up in Borgio, which is a kind of a resort, cooler, kind of up in the mountains and so forth. And he went to Mindoro, the island right south of Luzon, where he preached and established within that summer two churches. And so you have Benson then responsible for establishing a Church of Christ in Hong Kong, and then establishing churches in the Philippines. So therefore, there's a legacy of the Bensons in China, Hong Kong, and in the Philippines. But that's just the beginning of the story. It was in Canton where Benson and Oldham did their work. You have to understand, Canton probably was the first of the open cities in China. One of the first four or five open cities, but it was the easiest to get to because of the relationship to Hong Kong and everything. And so, for instance, the Baptist had been in Canton for 80 years. And here, Churches of Christ come in 1925. So as a result, the work was cut out for them. One of the things that Oldham was good at was publishing. He was responsible, and this just started in about 1929, first called the Canton Christian, and later on it was called the Oriental Christian. And the only full complement of that magazine that I have found is located in the Harding Library here. And let me say this, I think I'm responsible for getting it put into the special collections, because this was George Benson's personal copy, bound copy. And it had even mimeographed newsletters in the front of it. So it's a very valuable piece of research material. And so, so it was Oldham that published the, not only a paper for the American public, and but he also published a Chinese magazine for, and it had as many as 2,000 people who were reading it. He also published tracts, and I think I think he also translated and published McGarvey's Acts. This was the commentary that a lot of the missionaries really emphasized, was John McGarvey's book on commentary on Acts. Now, one of the things that they realized, and I think George Benson really realized it when he took a job at a university in Canton to teach English. He needed extra income. The Morrilton Church didn't provide enough, and so he needed some extra income. But in teaching, he realized the future of Churches of Christ in China was in educating the people. And so in the fall of 1929, they even started a small, teaching of the Bible, a Canton Bible School, although it was not formalized in any big way. But in 1930, George and Sally Benson had been in the Far East 5 years. What are you supposed to do after 5 years, Tom? Supposed to go home, aren't you? 5 years. That's time for the first break for missionaries, they say. 7 years for the second time. And so they came back to the States. Sally and the two girls now were visited parents, grandparents, and so forth. And George went to college. He went to the University of Chicago, where he earned his master's degree in, which is only natural then for him, which if he could have done it first, it might have been better, but who knows. But in kind of Oriental studies, culture of China, such things as this. And in many ways, when he went back to China, his vision of what to do was different. How to do it was different, I think. And so so this was a major, well, what's wrong with this thing? It won't move. Did it move?
Yep. There you go.
Okay. It went backwards. There we go. It is a different color in it. It's got too much green in it, as you were saying, I believe. Okay. He also had time to visit churches, renew acquaintances with Jay and Armstrong. And while at Harding, he recruited two additional missionaries for China, Lowell Davis and Roy Whitfield. Now, I will say this, of all the most persistent missionaries to the Far East, none outdid Lowell Davis and his wife, Odessa White Davis. They went to China three times. So it's a great story. And so they returned to Canton in 1932, of course, right in the depths of the Depression. And then the Oldhams left on a furlough. So it left only George and Sally there. But they had two chapels in Canton, two Chinese preachers. Progress was evident, I think any doubt about it. But it was time to begin preparing for the Canton Bible School for January 1933. It still was not a full-fledged with a curriculum that was set out. It was just basically to teach the Bible. But Benson was limited in what he could do. He had to publish the papers. He was now the Oriental Christian. He had to oversee the chapels. He had to preach the Chinese language. The Canton Bible School was his responsibility. I don't know how he did it. Had he not had two or three really good Chinese helpers, he could have never done it. And the thing is also interesting that he and Mr. Koh decided they needed to go to an outlying town to preach. And they were there several months. No results. But they felt they needed to get outside of Canton to do some preaching. But what the Bensons were awaiting was the coming of Davis and Whitfield. They're both bachelors. Now remember that. They're both bachelors. They were needed. The work was more than two men and their wives could do. So, we can't spend a whole lot of time in looking at other areas, but I think it's also important that we do look at Hong Kong, because this is where Benson really started his ministry. This is where the Brodesses and Ethel Madley worked. They went inland China, they were Hong Kong, but inland China was difficult. Bandits were everywhere, conflict between the provinces, and the rise of nationalist movement and the beginning of communism. All of this was a detriment to doing mission work, especially, I think, out in the countryside. So as a result, most of the efforts of these people were centered in Hong Kong. And the Brodesses story is very, very sad. At the birth of their third child, Margaret Brodus became ill and died. And so here is Emmett Brodus, who's not healthy anyways, has heart trouble, has three children to care for. Now, what do you think about that, being in Hong Kong? So, and the youngest of these children at her death was only 6 months. What do you do? And that's Emmett Brodus right there. That's taken off of that that same group of pictures. They came out pretty good, considering, when you just take them with your telephone. Mike?
Is there a biography
of him? No. Now, his son, Victor, is going to be very important in this whole story. And he was already born when they arrived in Hong Kong in 27. And so their lives were filled with tragedy, and yet their faith remained firm. Miss Madley, first arrived in China as a Baptist missionary, changed about 1925. She was supported by a church in Los Angeles, and she worked closely with the Brodesses. She will be caught in Hong Kong at the outbreak of the war. Emmett Brodus married Alice Lee on July the 8th, 1932. I wish we could had a full hour to talk about the Brodus family here, because I think it's needed, but we've got 50 minutes to cover everything. One article I read said that his home congregation ceased supporting him because Alice Lee was not Church of Christ. But he could not have handled all the things that were on his plate without her, and that she was a lifesaver for her. And in the meantime, she was kind of Pentecostal.
Yeah, but she was already in Hong Kong.
She was already in China, yes. In the meantime, and here's a great story, this one. Two single men, Bernard Wright and Charles Groover, from Louisville, Kentucky. They were both premillennials. I mean, major premillennials. They really emphasized Revelation. They arrived in North China in 1928 and 1929. They worked in the Hopi province. And it was one of the most difficult places because there was lots of banditry. The rise of conflict between Russia, Japan, and China was happening all this time. And travel was primitive, oftentimes by ox cart, and at the best, a bicycle over rutted roads. They did mostly street preaching, having a Chinese preacher accompany them wherever they went. When they would go into a community, they would just stand around, and people would say, "Preachers are here, preachers are here," and the crowd would gather. They'd hand out copies of the Gospels in Chinese, and they would preach to them. But it was hard. Wright even went into Lower Mongolia, looking for opportunities. But with 1937 and all the problems in China, with of course that was the year that the Japanese went into Nanking and killed so many people, called the Rape of Nanking, and all this was happening around Beijing or Peking then. And the American government said, "You fellas got to get out." And so Charles Gruber did, but Wright had already gone home in 35 with kind of a nervous breakdown. And so 37, there was nobody left in the Hopi things. But he comes back. Wright returned in 1940 and remained even after Pearl Harbor, December the 7th, 41. He spent World War II under arrest by the Japanese, first in his home, where he had opportunities to preach and everything and to teach. And then he was taken to the Weistein concentration camp in Shandong province. And as I say, again, that's a story that is so interesting. The Weistein concentration camp was located in the American Presbyterian compound known as the Courtyard of the Happy Way. He spent his time working in the kitchen baking bread. You would think, looking at those folks there, they didn't have much bread. This is a picture of some of the internees when Major Steiger and six men parachuted near their camp on October the 17th, 1945. They didn't know what they were parachuting in. They thought maybe the Japanese would be ready for them and fire at them. But the Japanese did not retaliate. It said that there were some in the camp that their job was to make sure that the Japanese did not do anything. But I don't think they had to, because they didn't. All years in the camp, Wright taught Bible in the camp. Now, most of the missionaries, a lot of the internees were missionaries, Catholic priests, nuns, Protestant missionaries, businessmen from Europe. It was about 2,000 people lived in the camp. But now the Japanese did not treat their internees like Americans treated the Japanese Americans in the camps here in this country. This going back to Pepperdine right quick. Pepperdine was a man of his word. He found Henry and Marie Cassell and their two sons to become missionaries on Mindoro Island. But because of both Henry and his wife, Marie, the Cassells lived in Manila and worked through native preachers and lengthy visits to the island. So they were never that engaged totally in the Mindoro work. Where Benson had been. Then in September 1932, Orville D. Rodman came back to the Philippines at the age of 40 to begin mission work in Mindoro. But after he worked in Mindoro for a while, he had been talking to before he left, and then while he was in Mindoro with a woman in California, and they decided to get married. Her name was Verly May Garrison. And George Benson performed their wedding service in Canton on June the 4th, 1934. And they transferred their mission effort to Mindanao Island in the southern part of the Philippines. And this is where, it's another story. We don't have time to tell it. But of all the mission opportunities, the Philippine Islands seemed to be the most inviting. See, Catholicism had been introduced in the 16th century, so most of the people had been introduced to God, to Christ, the death, the burial, and the resurrection. So they knew all of this. It's totally different from the Chinese. And so the mission work in some ways was a lot easier in the Philippines than in other places. Now, we go back to Canton again. For Canton, for the church in China to be successful, he believed the Canton Bible School must have its own building. So he proposed, Vincent proposed a special China Sunday scheduled for July in 1932. He had come back to Canton in 33, he came back in 32. And he said, here's the pressure now. If 1,000 churches, that's a lot of churches, would give $10, the entire amount could be raised in one day. I'm sorry to say it didn't happen. It didn't happen. But he continued. He had another campaign where he would try to get individuals to commit $100. And he got Jan Armstrong and others. I think he got people from Abilene and people from Lipscomb to commit $100, to go on. But they decided after a while to go on and construct the building on faith, and before they had all the money. It was during this period that Roy Whitfield and Lowell Davis arrived, and they will become invaluable to the China mission. In fact, Davis would spend much of his time in small town missions instead of in Canton, because he was a natural in learning the language. And so he learned the language where Whitfield did. But the year 1934 was memorable. Odessa White came to Hong Kong, was going into China. She had gone to high school in Louisville, Kentucky, at the Portland Christian School. She had studied under Robert Bowl at the Portland Church. And she would say later on that he was the most inspiring Bible teacher that she had ever known. Now, I don't think she was a premillennialist, but she certainly came out of Montana, went to Kentucky for school, and then from there, the Brodesses encouraged her to go to Hong Kong and to China as a missionary. So, on December the 17th, 1934, Lowell and Odessa were married. Then on July 1935, Roy Whitfield and Ida Ruth Gardner from California, he had been a student at the Nashville Bible School. I think he had taught with Armstrong at the Western Bible and Literary Institute. He was involved with Christian high schools in California. Her mother had died. She felt that she couldn't leave until her brothers got a little older. But Roy Whitfield and Ruth had already met, and so she came, and they were married. So you had two couples, more couples now to work. And then in February 1935, Lewis and Grace Oldham returned, and so this was the largest contingent of missionaries ever assembled in Canton, and it looked like things were really getting ready to really boom. With the Canton Bible School building completed, the future of the Churches of Christ in missions in Canton was very bright. But there remained a debt on the building to be paid, and certainly was difficult in time of economic crisis. With more teachers, the Bible School offered a full curriculum of Bible and related courses. Benson said it was the most important happening in mission work of Churches of Christ in China. And I think certainly it would have been had not all of the events of 1937 came pouring down on Canton. But in 1936, In 1936, Jan Armstrong persuaded George Benson to become president of Harding College. That must have been a blow to those young people in Canton. Roy Whitfield was made head over the school, and they had the largest enrollment the fall after Benson left. But 1936 also become crucial for the Canton mission. Lowell Davis contracted dysentery, and he needed to return to the U.S. for treatment. And in 1937, with all the problems with the Japanese as they began moving inland into China, the Americans had to leave China because of the conflict between Japan and China. And of course, this would require an entire session. That sentence should not be there. So the Bible school was now under Chinese Christians. Now, the dean was a Chinese person, which was good. The war scare was so bad, the British moved citizens from Hong Kong, including Alice Brodus, who was a Canadian citizen. And then she took all of six children, because there'd be one born in the Philippines, and went to the Philippines waiting for Emmett to come. Now, he visited a couple of times, but he did not want to leave the Chinese alone in Hong Kong. And so, but all of the things happened. December 7th, 1941, not only did they bomb Pearl Harbor, they bombed Manila, they bombed Hong Kong. So, I mean, it was a very planned thing that the Japanese did. And as a result, Emmett Brodus was in Hong Kong without his family. Edith Madeley was there. It was on February the 1st, 1942, that Emmett Brodus succumbed to his illness. His heart failed, and he died in Hong Kong. It would be a year before his family knew about it in the Philippines. Edith Madeley was put into a concentration camp. It was nice. It was a nice hospital and everything. But she was held prisoner for a while until she was repatriated and able to come back to the States. But that story is really something. I haven't, Mike, I'm sorry, I have not mentioned Elizabeth.
It's okay. I wanted to ask you, yeah. Brodus was buried, he had to be buried in Hong Kong.
Yes, oh yes, yes. Yes, he's still there. In fact, in the little book that Alice Brodus's daughter wrote, she has a picture of his tombstone. It was in Kowloon where he had to be, in Kowloon, across the way. Let me mention just briefly because it's a part of the story. The same time that Odessa White came to Hong Kong and then into China, Elizabeth Bernard and her mother, Estella, came to be missionaries in China. And she, Estella must have been up in years even when she first came. They worked some in Hong Kong, and when Odessa went to Canton to work there, she went with them and worked in outlying areas, and then right before the end of the Canton mission in 37, she was working there with Sally. She then went back to Hong Kong and remained there, but she sent her mother home. But she stayed in Hong Kong and got caught on December the 7th, and she went to Macau, you know, escaped there. Because in 1939, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but this is the way we can do it. In 1939, Lowell Davis and his wife and their children came back, hopefully to Canton, but they couldn't stay there. They went to Macau. And they reestablished the Bible school there. And Elizabeth Bernard was there as well. And the great story. And again, it's a dramatic story. They had to escape from Macau because the Japanese were taking it over fully. And this was about 1942, 43, where they had to escape by boat at night up the West River under cover of tarps over the boat to keep from being discovered by the Japanese gunboats. They crossed over a small mountain range into the Lee River, L-I River, which is a beautiful country over there, and made their way all the way to an American air base at Quilin. And there they remained until 1944, when the Japanese finally came in and were about to take over all that, and the American Army and Air Force destroyed all of these bases, burned them down, burned them to the ground. But they were able to take the Davises and Elizabeth Bernard out over the hump in a plane to escape. Now, what do you think about that story? See, that book needs to be written, doesn't it? Yes, sir.
I met one of the translators in Kunming he was a really young boy that had a knack for language. And he stopped me because I looked like a lost American. It wasn't hard at the time. And he goes, in perfect English, "Are you lost?" And he was wearing the traditional blue smocks and the giant bike, the thing that you see on PBS. And we talked for about 30 minutes, and man, I wish I had a camera.
Yeah. Well, that's I mean, it's such a great story.
He was very complimentary of the American pilots. They were very kind.
Well, you know about Chenault and the Flying Tigers. Well, this was one of those bases. So it's a great story. So I think we moved on and we got that story already. And then one of the great stories. My time is up. I don't know what we're going to do. The missionaries in the Philippines got caught there. They could not get out, and so they were taken into Japanese concentration camps. The Brodus family, the Cassell family, into Santo Tomas there in Manila. And then the Cassells were moved to Los Banos, another thing. Both of these camps had about 2,000. When they were freed after the war, MacArthur sent a contingent of tanks, broke through the Japanese lines, and rammed through the walls of Santo Tomas before the Japanese killed at least the men and free them. Look how young those soldiers are. You were talking about being idealistic, taking on anything. I mean, they could. And look at the American. This is, according to her daughter, the woman in the middle washing her hair is Alice Brodus. Now, in another book, it says it's Los Banos, but I'll take her word for it. Look at the men who were interned in Santo Tomas. In the little book that the daughter wrote, she tells, she takes material from Victor Brodus' diary that he took as to how life was in the camp. And it was brutal. And of course, this is Los Banos. And this was a daring raid to free them too. They had to cross a lake in amphibious vehicles and to get the people off out. Going the wrong way. Let me just tell you just two or three stories. The Davises returned to China after the war, three times now, 1947. They went back to Canton this time, and also a Curtis family, also Harding graduates, went there. It was a time that they were very successful in what they did. They started the Bible school again. They built an orphanage. They were baptizing people by the hundreds. Of course, in 1949, Mao Zedong defeated Chiang Kai-shek, and that was the end of the mission there. Victor Brodus, now let me tell you a quick story. Victor Brodus left the camp disillusioned with Christianity. He went back to Kentucky, came under the influence H.L. Rutherford, who was preaching for a church in Lexington, Kentucky. You can guess what kind of church it was, okay? And then he came to Harding. He's a Harding graduate, as is his brother David. David died just a couple of years ago. Victor met May Webb from Texas, and she wanted to marry a missionary. She married Victor. They went in 1951, they went to Manila, where they remained almost 20 years. But if you read the Gospel Advocate and the Firm Foundation, you would never know it.